Hi, I'm Serena Jedalina, and welcome to the second mission membership live stream here at the Himalayan Institute in Honesdale, Pennsylvania. We appreciate everyone here for joining us here in Honesdale and also everyone out there on the web. Welcome. Today's live stream is with Rolf Sovik on the art of mantra meditation, and it's made possible because of the generous support of all of our new mission members. Rolf Sovik is the president and spiritual director of the Himalayan Institute. He has been studying yoga, he has studied yoga in the United States, Nepal, India, and he was initiated in the Himalayan tradition as a pundit in 1987. He holds degrees in clinical psychology, in philosophy, Eastern studies, and music. And as well, he's the author of Moving Inward, the co-author of the award-winning Yoga Mastering the Basics, and is a new contributor to our recently launched Amrit blog on the Wisdom Library. So as mission members, new mission members, all of you, you help make all of this possible. And you can be expecting more live streams. Next month we'll have Sherry Fredrickson speaking, and the following month will be Sandy Anderson. And because of your support, you also allow the Himalayan Institute to fulfill its core mission to inspire, educate, and empower all who seek to experience their full potential. Thank you very much. And without further ado, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Rolf Sovik, presenting on the art of mantra meditation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rolf.
Nice to be here. Hello, everyone here and everyone not here. It's a great pleasure to welcome you to the Institute at campus in midwinter, and to have a chance to think about some topics, some thoughts that really we don't have enough time to share with one another. Thoughts about meditation and the practice of using a mantra. I thought before we launch into the discussion of the mantra itself, it might be helpful to think a little bit about meditation, and for me to tell you just a bit about my own background. Because I want you to know that I'm not telling you how to meditate in a manner that I've made up. In fact, I am a long ways away from making up meditation methods. I am here to talk about the practice of meditation as I've been taught by Swami Rama, the founder of the Himalayan Institute. I met him quite a long time ago now, 1972. And during that first meeting, he had a chance to talk with me briefly, privately, and he said an interesting thing, to me at least. He said, "Do you meditate?" And I couldn't think for a moment what to say to him. I was a beginning meditator. He was certainly someone who I had a high esteem for. And so I thought what to say, and I answered him by saying, "Not really." That was an honest answer for me, and it gave a chance for me to hear him reply, "You should learn to meditate. I will teach you." And with that, I started a practice of meditation, actually within the week. That's been a long time now, but for the most part, that meditation has remained unbroken. It's a chance for me to sit quietly and, in the process of doing it, to learn a good deal more about what life is and about my own life. I began thinking about this talk by wondering what it is that we all could share at the beginning. And certainly one of the things we do all share is an interest in the process of meditation itself. Why do we do it? Why do any of us sit down each day and quiet ourselves and hope that something comes out of that that will be of value to us lifelong? That kind of discussion that we have with ourselves usually leads to a list. And if I were to list the basic reasons that any of us meditate, I think most of us would include on that list some sort of healing process, some unfolding of ourself, and some nod, at least, in the direction of enlightenment. It's a big word, not something that we can easily say that we understand. But on the other hand, if we didn't have some faith that this process of meditation leads us beyond where we are now, I think we would be disappointed in our motive. We need something greater than ourselves. So healing, unfolding, enlightenment. Another day, perhaps, we can talk about these in more detail, but enlightenment, for example, or healing, certainly provide for us an opportunity to think about what we need and where we are beginning in our spiritual path. So assuming that these are at least some of the goals that bring us to meditation, there is also an important question raised by how do you meditate? What is the process of meditating? And for us, that process is certainly one which leads us from our goal to a somewhat more practical view. What is it that leads us, or that provides a substantive method of meditation for us? That substantive method has to come from somewhere. As I mentioned, I didn't invent meditation, and nor did anyone here in this room do it. We are all people who are learning a tradition of practice and using that tradition as a way of entering into our own lives. So the question of what is meditation, how do these goals fit into the nature of meditation itself, is an important question. And if we were to ask the question, what is meditation, we need an answer something like this. Meditation is the mastery of the roaming tendencies of mind. This comes directly from the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, Sutra 2. Meditation is the mastery of the roaming tendencies of mind. Mastery is an important word, big word, of course. Roaming tendencies, something familiar to all of us. Mastery of the roaming tendencies is a something which seems down the road a bit. And yet, we all sit down regularly to meditate, thinking that this is another opportunity to do it, to gain some internal idea of how the roaming tendencies of mind might be calmed. We do it because what lies beneath those roaming tendencies are these three things and more. We quiet the roaming tendencies of mind because by doing it, something emerges in us. We say that there is a healing, then there must be a healer. That healer within us gives us an opportunity to grow, to change. And when we do sit with ourselves with that idea of growth and change, it allows us to contemplate the method of change, the striking changes that occur to us over weeks, months, and a lifetime. There certainly could be a little bit of controversy over what I'm saying next. I'm saying it, though, because I think it's important for us to begin to get a grasp of what this bigger picture of meditation is. And we now have literature that makes it sound as if there are different kinds of meditation. There might be different religions of meditation. There might be different practices of meditation that change entirely the flavor of what we do when we meditate. For example, there are people who say that they do or they don't practice mantra meditation, or they do and they don't practice some sort of distancing from within themselves and watchfulness in meditation. If we look exclusively at one or the other, we'll begin to, I think, get misled by the practice. That this practice of meditation that we are working with here includes both a concentration aspect and a distancing aspect, a mantra and other things as a focus, and a quiet sitting back, watching watchfulness. Without those two elements of practice combined, we really miss out on the whole scope of practice that we could be learning. So I'd like to give you just a little bit more of an introduction to the idea of these two things together in one practice. Why do I have some confidence that this is a good method for meditation? Let me ask the question of you. How is healing, unfolding, and enlightenment, how is it accomplished? It is accomplished, according to Patanjali, the great sage around the 2nd century BC, who said that meditation is accomplished through practice. That seems reasonable. And non-attachment. These two things together, abhyasa, the word practice in Sanskrit is abhyasa. The word non-attachment is vairagya. So this sutra that says the answer to the question, how are these things accomplished, says abhyasa vairagyabhyam tan nirodha. Abhyasa vairagyabhyam, by practice and by non-attachment, tan nirodha, the quieting and stilling of the mind is accomplished. So we're interested in doing exactly that. Patanjali's focus is on the practice side. And Patanjali focused, not entirely, but a great deal on the idea of how do you collect your energies? How do you take these random thoughts, roaming thoughts, and bring them together into one place? The Bhagavad Gita says that place where thought comes to rest, that's the resting place we're looking for. And by finding that place and staying there, we gradually gain some mastery of it. So Patanjali says, practice, non-attachment, is largely the theme of the Bhagavad Gita. And the teacher there is Krishna. What does Krishna say is the method for accomplishing these things? Interestingly, he says exactly the same thing. Chapter 6, verse 20, that the practice of non-attachment and practice, gradually gathering the mind into a focus, is precisely the thing which leads toward enlightenment. There is a foundation. We can add that foundation and then we've got a complete picture. The foundation is the eight limbs of yoga. In a sense, that diagram we could think of as the universal triangle of yoga. That someone learning different paths of yoga will find that somehow or another their path fits very nicely on this diagram. And the reason it seems to do that so well is because this diagram represents many different paths collected into one path. So practice includes many different styles of concentration. Non-attachment is especially well known for karma yoga, but also bhakti yoga, jnana yoga. And the eight limbs of yoga, Patanjali's description of how you go about, in a big sense, collecting your life energies and focusing them in this way. So that's a starting point. We have at least now have a place to begin to understand what will come next. However, we probably need to ask one or two more questions. For example, here's a question. What is practice? Practice doesn't seem to be quite concise enough a word to really help us know what to do next. But the idea of practice is really quite clearly delineated by Patanjali. And for those of you who like to look up these passages, if you go to Yoga Sutra, chapter 1, verse 12, that asks the question, what is practice? And Patanjali's answer to the question, he raises the question and answers it himself. His answer is, practice is the effort to rest the mind in its own peaceful flow. The effort to rest the mind in its own peaceful flow. What is non-attachment? The relaxation of clinging for things seen that we already have seen, or things that we have only heard about. Put those two things together. Practice, the effort to relax the mind in its own peaceful flow, and non-attachment, the letting go of clinging. You can see that we're already starting to give shape to a meditation practice that contains two elements. One element is focus. The other element is a quiet distancing. Focus and distancing. These are the two things that occur at the same time in meditation. We have different practices. Some of us have been to the tops of mountains or to the desert islands, or who knows where we've been in our meditation practice, guided there by visual imagery. And certainly there are times when that visual imagery helps us calm down, especially on stressful days when we need to relax. But it may be also helpful for us to recognize that we can combine these two things, a focus and a sense of distance, in any meditation practice, with or without imagery, so that in the practice of gradually centering the mind in its focus, we simply need to know what is the focus that's going to gather me. What is that thing which will gradually become so important to me that I hear it before I go to sleep at night, and I hear it first thing in the morning when I wake up? That focus needs to be also something that can be refined. So many times we have something as a starting point, but we refine that into something more elegant or more refined than we were when we started. So a focus can be something that changes over time. And on the other hand, the sense of distancing we know in meditation to be the feeling of awakening, the feeling of becoming the observer or the witness of our own thoughts. You can see now that some of the elements of meditation that we thought were exclusively belonging to one school or another may not be quite so much the case. It may certainly be the case that instead of being one school or another, these many schools all find a home in one general consistent practice of focusing and non-attachment. One of the important things that we need to know in order to establish this pattern or this understanding of the basic framework of meditation is that if there is a focus, that focus must be something which holds the mind, keeps it safe. There is, for example, the idea that when you meditate on your focus, the focus becomes the resting place. There is a word for that kind of thing. The word for the focus or the resting place is alambana. A focus is an alambana. An alambana is a thing given by a teacher or given to a student to use as their resting place. You can see that we're heading in the direction of receiving or using a mantra in practice, that at some point a mantra becomes a gift. Gift from a teacher to a student to provide an anchor or a resting place for their mind. That focus is called an alambana, and the word alambana is the general word for all of the different kinds of focus that we might use in meditation. So that alambana might start out to be something like stillness. And in the meditation tradition that's represented here at the Himalayan Institute, when a person begins to meditate, the first thing that they do is to begin to cultivate stillness. Try it for a moment just now. Sit comfortably back in your chair so that you're resting. Let your arms rest in your lap. And just for a moment, let your eyes close. We're not going to sit long, but for a moment, be aware of the space around you. Sense your own body. And as you sense your body, soften the way you hold yourself. Letting the weight of your body settle down. There is a sense that as you rest the way, as you soften the way you hold yourself, you gradually let the chair or the floor beneath you hold you. Rest in a feeling of stillness. And let that stillness hold you. Now, as you continue to rest, shift your awareness to the flow of your breathing. Breathing out and breathing in, sense the flow of your breath, and let that breath flow without pause between breaths. The exhalation cleanses, the inhalation nourishes. Just rest for a moment longer. And then gently deepen your breath once more. Bring your awareness back out. So the process of meditation is something that you can enter into quite easily. It begins by softening the way you hold your body and letting your body become the relaxed focus of your attention. The first step, in other words, is to rest your body and rest your awareness in that stillness. If we were to begin our memorization, so to speak, of the method, how do you go about this method? The first step in doing it might be to begin to bring the focus to the body, rest the body in stillness, and let some time pass. As time passes, a feeling of restfulness will begin to encompass the whole body. So our system of meditation will include the refining of that focus. The first step is stillness, then breathing. After a period of time of watching the flow of the breath, the focus is shifted to the breath in the nostrils. And we'll feel the touch of breath there for a bit. Finally, we'll bring attention to the sound in the mind, and we'll have to think a little bit about what have we done in order to make it easily accessible to come from outside, in which at a time when our mind is gathering sense experience in the world around us, how have we done it so that easily we've moved from that outward experience of life to a much more focused inward experience. That's where we're going, and that's what we'd like to understand the role of mantra to play in this process. But let me see if we've got everything done. There is another way in which we should think about this. We want to advance in our practice. All of us would like it if we could become a little bit more deeply focused. And if we do, we expect that that sense of the inner healer will emerge in us, that there will be a feeling of joy or happiness that is not extinguished but stays there, lighting itself in its own way. And we may even find that there are times when in meditation we are uncertain about the future and we want to adjust our own mind to that. So we gradually become more confident in ourselves and answer questions that we have. So there are many changes that we might say indicate for us that meditation is deepening and that things are going well in life. One of the ways in which we also might want to think about meditation is how do you, in the midst of a meditation practice, how do you combine both this focus and non-attachment that we've been talking about? And I'd like to give you an illustration which may not make any sense at first, but that's all right, we'll try it. Suppose that this is your meditation practice. And on the one hand, there is a process of focusing. Then on the other hand, there is a process of awakening, becoming the observer. So what is meditation? Meditation somehow is the practice of bringing the observer and the focus together. If you come out of meditation, then probably you come back out to the objective world, and your focus spreads into the bigger world as well. So a meditation method that really seems to work is to awaken the observer gradually to be the witness and to refine the object of concentration so that those two things merge. It makes it possible, if you can do it, to both focus and witness at the same time. And that's exactly the thing we're trying to accomplish. We would like to both witness and narrow the concentration at the same time. So, of all the things that we might focus on, what we're going to discover as we go along this afternoon is that the primary focus in meditation becomes a focus within the mind itself. If we can focus the mind in the mind, then that focus will become subtle. We will have to, of course, learn a little bit more about how to do that. And that's what at least some of this afternoon is meant to be, an opportunity to think about how to take the concentration that we've established outside ourselves, refine it, and make it a tool for resting inside ourselves for increasingly longer periods of time. It really doesn't sound so hard, and in fact, I remember listening to Swami Rama talk about meditation one time, and he said such an interesting thing. He said that meditation really is quite a simple thing, not complicated. If you can practice this fairly simple method, it will be fine. What makes it a bigger project is the philosophy behind it. So it may be the case that we will learn a method, learn to trust it, and then discover that we still have a big story in front of us to read. That story is the story about who we are, what we are trying to accomplish, and why it seems possible to do it through this meditation method. This is normally the place where I stop and say, do you have any questions? But you're sitting in Brussels at the moment, so you can't answer quite yet. What I'd like to do then is just to take you through a few more ideas related to these two things. We've got one step in front of us. Let's put a few more steps in. And we have a basic idea of distancing, but let's see if we can find some language that makes that distancing process a little bit more accessible to us. So what kind of focus, and how do you refine the focus to make it something valuable in your practice? We have experienced already just the basic idea that resting in a steady, comfortable posture is the beginning point. That gives us some time to draw inside. It happens that in the process of trying to do that, however, the mind wanders. We discover that instead of drawing inside, we are sitting here thinking about outside things. And we need to accomplish a little bit more steadiness in that. So the first thing perhaps to do in the process of steadying that focus is to give yourself more time. We're going to discover the same thing when we begin to work on the meditation method, that we are wanting to give ourselves more time in order to give the mind an opportunity to settle into the focus. So whereas it could be that in a very experienced meditator, sitting down, closing the eyes, almost takes you directly there, it may also be that that's just the starting point for this first element of focus. That sitting quietly allows you the opportunity to rest the arms, center yourself, let your mind soften the way you hold yourself, and then let the posture hold you. So this process of steadying your body is not simply an empty process of hoping it will happen, but the cue is soften the way you hold yourself. You are holding yourself in some way right now. I am too. We hold ourselves in a way that seems comfortable to us, but we also do it because in some way we don't want our head chopped off, we don't want our legs removed. We want everything to be collectively drawn together and held together, and safely, we want to be safe. So suppose that you have this idea that you could enter into a safe quietness inside you without worrying that there will be some disastrous thing befalling you, that actually the way you soften yourself is to soften the way you are really holding your limbs. That softness of your body becomes something useful. Quiet softness in your legs, arms, trunk, neck, and head. As time progresses, that softness evolves, because the body, mind and body naturally want to go in the direction of movement. Seems a little odd. At first I'm thinking I want to be still, and what do? I go toward movement. But I go toward movement because my mind is attracted to it. I see something moving outside. I'm much more interested in that than I am seeing nothing move. And so the process of relaxing and meditating begins by quieting movement and moving into stillness, at which point you discover movement once more. What sort of movement do you discover? It's the movement of breathing. So the second focus is a focus on the flow of breath. If we focus on that breath, we'll discover that the movement is not something caused by me or you. We don't sit consciously trying to move. But the movement of breathing is something that occurs effortlessly. It begins to link us to that sutra of Patanjali's, the effort to rest the mind in its peaceful flow means that I am gradually learning to refine my effort, make it softer and more quiet. And as I soften that, I begin to notice the flow of breath, and the breath becomes my object of attention. So the second object, the breath, is something that flows effortlessly by itself, and yet as I watch it, I begin to discover that that effortless breath has a good effect on me. The longer I breathe effortlessly, the more my inner attention softens and becomes relaxed. Breath is directly connected to the autonomic nervous system. And when I soften the way I hold my body, soften the grip I have on my breathing, what emerges is a feeling of quietness in my nervous system. I have a sort of descriptive way of knowing that it's happening in me. What I say is this. I might not actually do it, but I certainly feel it. And when I feel it, at that moment, the whole body and its internal nervous system calm down. We're not quite done. The second focus is something quite wonderful and elaborate, more than what we can talk about now, but maybe something for the future. But what we are moving toward is a sense that I am not the breather. I want to be able to watch the flow of the breath, but not be the breather. If I ask the question, who is the breather, it comes with a fairly simple answer. The body breathes. So the process of resting your body, feeling the flow of the breath, and letting the body breathe gradually brings you to the awakening of the observer. Which is symbolized by a pair of glasses. If there are any musicians in the audience, you'll know why that is. Those glasses represent the words, pay attention. And if you're playing anything important and difficult, what your mind will say when it sees those glasses is, look up, pay attention, a difficult passage is on the way. So we're not looking up with quite so much intensity, but we do have the feeling that as I notice the breath, as I follow the breath, let it flow out and in without my effort to breathe, At that very moment, I begin the process of waking up, of being the observer, witnessing the mind and body, and gradually sensing that this witnessing process is able to maintain a focus at the same time that you awaken a quiet distancing inside. So we'll talk more about it in a moment, but two things have happened so far. We've focused the body, or focused on the stillness of body, and we have focused on the flow of breathing. And we've done that, and at the same time, gradually become aware of the fact that I am not the body, I am not the breath, I am the witness, the distancing witness inside. The third focus is something that I've thought about for some time. I've thought that if I were to invent a meditation method, I would somehow have to hit on the idea of feeling the breath in the nose. That feeling of the breath in the nostrils is something that every meditation method seems to use. And so if we were to begin to focus on the breath in the nostrils, we would notice that it has a temperature, warm as it flows out, cool as it flows in. That breath flowing out and in, the coolness and warmth of the breath, is something which persists even without my effort. I know that the breath is going to continue to flow, but now I'm also aware that there is a sense of touch, a feeling of the breath inside the nostrils. It's a refined sense, something that you could be hard-pressed to duplicate. Yet once you've found that breath, it continues to provide a sensation, a focus, without much effort. That's the main thing. The effortless flow of breath now becomes a focus of attention. And as you focus your attention on that effortless flow of breathing, touching in the nostrils, you might notice that the thing that you are attending to is not so much the feeling of breathing as it is the sensation of a touch. So here you are focusing on the breath in the nostrils, but you are focusing on not so much the flow of breathing as the touch of breath. That is a sense, not sight, not smell, not hearing, but a sense of touch. So we are gradually wanting to focus more and more on the sense of touch, because as I focus on one touch, one sensation, the others refine and travel in, they begin to turn inward. That process of turning the mind inward is the focus of refining the touch, refining the focus, and bringing us to the threshold of what we are here to talk about. As you continue to feel the touch of breath in the nostrils, your mind will naturally begin to move in, and in that moving in, it will look for an object in the mind. So every meditation method, to some degree, uses the system of focusing. And every meditation, to some degree, uses the system of watching and observing. And now those two, at this moment in time, meet. And as they meet, they greet one another. I am the witness, the observer of the mind. And this touch of breath is the focus. These two merged. They have now become one single focus. The observer and the observed are beginning to coalesce. That coalescence, the joining of them, seeks something in the mind. The mind is now like a queen with her followers ready to be drawn in. Her followers are the breath, And that queen is moving inward, turning inward, looking for a focus that resides in the mind itself. The first focus, the first thing which is used for training in meditation, is not so much to use a mantra yet, but to turn the mind inward using counting. You can count one on the exhalation, two on the inhalation, three on the exhalation, and up to five, and then from five back down to three on the inhalation, two on the exhalation, one on the inhalation, and start over. One on the exhalation, and continue. So one through five, five through one, the mind is drawn toward the breath, and feeling the breath adds to it the count. One through five, five through one. As the breath becomes the focus of attention, and as that focus of attention becomes a sensation, and as that sensation turns inward into the mind looks for an object in the mind, and it starts by counting. But soon it wants something more like the energy that is in the mind itself. That turning of the mind inward at some point looks for a sound, and it's a sound that's unique, a sound called a mantra. The word man means to think or a thought. The word tra means to protect or to guide. A mantra is a sound, a resting place, which protects and guides. In a certain way, if we didn't know anything beyond that, if we knew only that the mind protects and guides when it reaches into a sutra, a mantra, then we might be satisfied that the practice is exactly what we're looking for. We were looking for healing, for unfolding, and enlightenment. And what we found in this process is that now the mind is resting in the mind in a sound which protects, nourishes, guides. It's a unique thing. Some of the mantras have deities connected to them. Some are called Hindu mantras, some are called Christian mantras, some are called Buddhist mantras. But it doesn't seem to be the case that that's actually the truth. Once, when I was curious, I had heard about a mantra, and I went to Swami Rama and asked him about that particular mantra and what he could say to add to my very limited knowledge. This mantra had to do with a goddess whose name was Sarasvati. So I asked him, could you tell me more about this mantra? And he said, well, what do you know so far? And I said, well, I know it has something to do with Sarasvati. And he said, forget that Sarasvati business. I didn't really know what he was talking about. He said, forget that Sarasvati business. This is a sound. A sound contains and encompasses a vibration. That vibration has a meaning. And that meaning is something great. Then he told me some of the things about the meaning of that mantra. And what he said at the end was, it's not the deity, not Christian, not Buddhist, not Hindu. It is the meaningfulness of the sound that's carried in the sound itself. So I have come to a mantra inside myself by using a method. The method takes me through steps one, two, three, and now the fourth step, mantra. And that mantra now means something to me. It means a place in which my mind can be held and comforted, nourished and strengthened by the repetition of the sound of the mantra in the mind. Should I still be holding on to the breath at this point? It depends. breathing may be helpful with certain mantras, but more commonly not. At some point, the first mantra that's taken up by any system of practice is a mantra that connects to the breath. So we might, and we do here at the Institute, start with a mantra, So Hum. There's so much to say about any particular mantra, but we should at least say something to acknowledge the meaning of this mantra. The mantra So Hum is a mantra that coordinates with breathing. The sound aham, which is part of that mantra, is in the yoga tradition a way of verbalizing the concept of I. Aham is a verbalization of the concept of I. So is a verbalization of the concept of that. But we do have to ask what in the world that means, I and that. The mantra So Hum, which is written this way, has two parts, the verbalization of I and the verbalization of that. When these two are put together, side by side, when you put one thing side by side with another, the two become merged, equivalent. I and that come together. I am that is the result. I, the consciousness that I am, that, the pure consciousness which exists deep in the heart of me, these two things, I and that, they merge together into one thing. I am that. And so as a result, I begin to have the sense that the repetition of the mantra leads me, guides me, supports me. And that precisely is what the practice of meditation is doing. There are a number of mantras. Perhaps the one that's most familiar to us after this one, So Hum, might be the mantra Om. Pandit Rajmani Tikkanayat, the author of a wonderful book, series of books now, on the Yoga Sutras, has written about a sutra in which the mantra described is the mantra Om. I think the number is Sutra 128. And if you look in that mantra, you'll see that he writes about the idea of Om. And what he says is that Om has a reputation, a sort of reputation as the great mantra, the only mantra. Certainly Patanjali in his text, first chapter, he says as much, says that Om is the mantra. But if we were to go look into it a little farther, we would begin to suspect that there must be more mantras than that one. It must be the case that that one mantra is representative of something. And in fact, it is. It's representative of a whole system of mantras. That system of mantras is something which is introduced to you by the sound So Hum, and which ultimately may take us through many journeys before we come to our home, but that in one way or another, these mantras that we learn, they are friends with one another. They're not isolated incidents in a history of isolated visualizations. But no, these are mantras which step by step lead through. There is certainly some individual variation. One person might receive one mantra and another another. But if we were to look over time, we'd find that these mantras are united. They have a way of joining with one another. And that the nature of the mantra, the thing that's common about them all, is that they make one new. Meditation and mantra, meditation in particular, makes one new. This newness awakens us. It gives us a sense that we are something deeper than we suspected, and that by practicing meditation, we begin to discover that in the very fact of sitting and quieting ourselves. So meditation, and particularly the mantra sound in the meditation, makes one new. That newness is who you are. Which brings us right back to the sound Soham. There are a number of other mantras. These other mantras that we should talk about briefly all have some of the qualities that we're looking for in a mantra, trying to understand the process of it. And among those mantras, two particularly are well known. These are mantras from the Vedas. The first is called the Gayatri Mantra. Om Pur Bhuva Swaha Tat Savitur Varenyam Bhargo Devasya Dhimahi Dhyo Yo Na Prachodayat. This is a mantra which is both a story or prayer and a mantra, that is a vibration. The prayer aspect of it is, O Lord, shine light on me. May my mind, in particular my inner mind, be illuminated. This idea of illumination is the core thing of the mantra, called the Gayatri Mantra. And someone learning to practice may soon discover that the Gayatri Mantra is a good accompaniment to their practice, or one, or a mantra that might become something that you settle with. The nature of the Gayatri Mantra also is that it has its own rhythm. Om Pur Bhuva Swaha Tat Savitur Varenyam Bhargo Devasya Dhimahi Dhyo Yo Na Prachodayat. The rhythm of the mantra seems to make it something that flows nicely in the mind and heart. And so when we're first learning these mantras, it's helpful to learn not only the correct pronunciation, but also the rhythmic flow of the mantra. Similarly, there is a mantra from the Vedas, again, called the Maha Mrityunjaya Mantra. This mantra also has a rhythm. Om Triyambakam Yajamahe Sugandhim Pushtivardhanam Urvarukamiva Bandhanan Mrityor Mukshiyam Amritarum Triyambakam Yajamahe Sugandhim Pushtivardhanam Varakamiva Bandhanan Mrityor Mukshiyam Amritat. Again, this is a mantra which is both a prayer and a mantra, that is, a prayer with a petition and a mantra sound which vibrates in, within. So what does the prayer mean? I am a plant, you are the gardener. I am the plant that has come to fruition, you are the one who helps me leave the vine, journey out on my own. And in that process, may you lead me, may you guide me from mortality attached to the vine to immortality free. So the process of reciting the mantra is a process of moksha, freedom. Freedom doesn't in any case mean separating oneself from reality. This freedom that we're talking about is a freedom which allows one to know the self within the self. And though we may not be certain that we are there this lifetime or next, there is something about the nature of this process of gaining insight through meditation that does seem to intrigue us, and then beyond that, leads us. There are other mantras. Some of those mantras are well known, some are not so well known. And the purpose of life is not to gather mantras. But the nature of the practice that we're doing is to use the mantra as a means for self-transformation. This self-transformation process occurs to us by a kind of gentle transformation of mind. Suppose that someone were to ask you this question, what is your name? It might certainly be that your answer to that question carried with it some interesting accompaniments. My name reveals to me something about me, about myself. If I said to you, what is this? You would easily say it's a marker. So the word marker conveys with the meaning of the word marker. It conveys a certain reality, not a very wonderful one, but still useful. If I said to you, what is your mantra? You might hesitate saying it. But it has some inner reality for you. And it's an inner reality that you would not be likely to reveal very easily. So normally, the idea of revealing a mantra, especially a mantra that's been given to you by a teacher, is not something that we would do just half-handedly. But we certainly understand that a mantra is a kind of transformative method. It's a tool or a focus in which the mind rests, and in the process, the mind itself is filled by the sound or the vibration of a mantra. The mantras often have common themes. One of those common themes is not so much the mantra as it is the practitioner of the mantra. The practitioner of the mantra has a theme or an idea that at some point in this process, the mantra is going to be given with love for the practitioner and with the practitioner's love for the mantra combined. So that idea that these two things are woven together and combined in one single practice makes it a little bit easier for us to understand what we are to do in meditation. And it also can, in some instances at least, help us understand the meaning of the mantra a little bit better. For example, the Mahamrityunjaya mantra that I was reciting earlier, Om Triambakam Yajamahe. The word Yajamahe means we worship, we adore, we love. The Gayatri mantra says Dhimahi, Om Bhur Bhuvasaha. Tat savitur vrainyam bhargo dhimahi dhiyo yona. I meditate on, I come close to it in my heart. And many mantras in the tradition also include a word which is not so unfamiliar, I think, to most people. Namaste is a word that we know quite well. Nama is found in many mantras. It's a wonderful mantra because of its nature. The nature of nama is, I bow with my heart and my head and my hands. So bowing with head, heart, and hands becomes part of the mantra, part of the meaning of the mantra. In this way, mantras have meanings, but the meanings that they have are not meanings which are rigid. They are meanings that unfold over time, and they are meanings which have a sort of heartfelt meaning inside them. Something which allows us to maintain contact with them throughout our day. Is that the end of the story? Not really, not quite. The mantra practice itself becomes more refined over time. So when a mantra is given, for example, the mantra is given to you because that mantra is somehow received in meditation and given to you for your meditation. A mantra that is given in that way starts out, it has to be said out loud. In order to transmit a mantra from one person to another, you have to say it. So that saying of it is something that occurs quite early on. It's called vaikari, the audible recitation of a mantra. But very soon, a person who practices knows that it's possible that one could go beyond that. In refining the mantra, one goes beyond the audible sound. And I may say the mind in my mind, say the mantra in my mind. If I do that, I say the mantra, but I articulate it in the mind. That's called madhyama. Madhyama means in the middle. It's not completely silent, it's flowing in my mind, but it's not audible either. Then from madhyama comes paschanti. Paschanti means that which has been seen by a seer, a sage, that which is known, known by those swans who know the meanings of mantras. So that brings us to a more refined concentration, and then beyond that, one more stage called para. Para is that stage in which the mind goes beyond itself into silence. The observer remains, the observer witnesses this silent presence and knows that soham, I am that. So this long journey from body to breath to sense experience to the rudiments of sound in the mind to a refined concentration, and a concentration that gradually leads us to silence, this whole journey is the journey of meditation. And it's one of those journeys that seems to be never tiring for a practice that has delighted in it. One of the things that we were hoping to do is to collect some questions from people who might have been listening in. You've heard about a whole system of mantras, and I know that some of you are more advanced than I've been talking to. But on the other hand, I think all of us need to hear and appreciate this journey that meditation and mantra take us on. But are there any questions? Serena might have some.
Hi. Thank you for that, Rolf. We do have a few questions that were collected before the live stream began over the course of this past week. The first question: I'm hoping you might offer some guidance on how to make the transition from thinking a mantra to listening to a mantra. The example is, in the first, the mind is actively thinking it, and the latter, the mind rests in awareness and simply listens. The person says, I can do this with shorter mantra, i.e. the Nivarna, but I'm having trouble with longer ones, i.e. the Rudra Gayatri.
First of all, a practical thing. Going from one mantra to another changes the rhythm in your mind. And so it needs to be practiced with lots of repetitions. Repetitions are what really will make it possible for the mantra to emerge on its own. But without those repetitions, I'll try to remember the mantra and focus on it, but I'll fall back. Patanjali has a word for that or a phrase for that, unable to hold on, unable to maintain. So the first thing to do is just look practically. Have you done it a long time? If you haven't done it for a long time, keep doing it and things will go well. But it's also the case that the technical problem is a little bit more technical. And it's a common experience for many people that as they work on reciting the mantra in the mind, the breath doesn't coordinate with the mantra any longer. And because that breath doesn't coordinate, I try to remember the breath and the mantra at the same time, but I lose track of the mantra in the disruption to the breath. So the answer to how to do it is second step in doing it after the first step is keep doing it. Second step is that in the process of doing it, try to feel the flow of the breath and get the breath to flow smoothly from breath to breath without pause. Then begin the work of monitoring the sound of the mantra. Otherwise, the mantra will be disturbed by breathing and it won't work out. I think maybe that those are the two technical things. The third thing is not technical at all. Swami Rama said it in an interesting way, very biblical way. He said, let your whole mind be an ear and listen with that ear. So you have to listen with your whole self, not with the limited self that we normally listen with. If we can identify the sound of the mantra as something that fills the whole space of the mind, then gradually that space will become naturally yours and the mantra will repeat itself. So just to say it for those who are not familiar with this, the idea of the mantra repeating is called japa. Japa means the repetition of a sound. The idea of the mantra repeating in the mind effortlessly is called ajapa japa. Ajapa japa comes about through practice. So I wouldn't worry if it hasn't happened yet. But I would, especially with those longer mantras that this person's talked about, I would try to pay attention to what's happening with breathing. That'll be the most important tool.
Thanks. Second question. For a mantra to work effectively, how important is it for the practitioner to believe in God, represented by the Hindu God-related name used in the mantra?
Well, I told that story about Swami Rama and him saying, forget that Sarasvati business. It's funny because Sarasvati, if you see an image of her, sits on a seat, wonderful lotus seat, and is beautiful goddess, dressed in white, and she has four arms. So for someone who is not familiar with the goddess of four arms, having to think about this Hindu goddess can throw us off, make us think that we are changing religion or being proselytized to. It might be more helpful, though, if we try to understand what Swami Rama was saying and what the image of Sarasvati as a goddess with four arms means. Because it's not so much that this goddess has four arms as she has four qualities. Qualities which light up her being. And one quality that she has is the quality of harmony. Well, if you look at the statue of her, it turns out that she plays a veena. A veena is a musical instrument. And the musical instrument in this case is a string instrument, and she weaves by playing that string instrument the harmony of the universe. Her other hand plays the veena as well. She needs two hands to play this instrument. Then she has a third arm, and in that third arm she holds a book. That book is a typical ancient Indian book. That is, it's two slabs of wood surrounding parchment paper. And in that book, who knows, but it's the book symbolizes wisdom. And then in her fourth hand, she holds mala. So mala is a symbol, really, of the repetition of the mantra. Brings us back to the goal of yoga. What is this goal of yoga? Ultimately, enlightenment, wisdom. And so the goddess Sarasvati is not so much the goddess that requires you to believe in the one with four arms and sits on a lotus. In fact, for most of us, the lotus that we'd like to sit on doesn't grow in this part of the world. We only know the lotus that grows in other parts of the world. So we don't have to believe or not believe in anything. But it is true that we have to devote ourselves. The idea of meditation is that it brings a culmination to 5, actually 10, yamas and niyamas. These 10 yamas and niyamas conclude with the niyama self. My goodness. they conclude with the idea of trustful surrender. The idea of trustful surrender is unique. That is, I trustfully surrender to the will of one who holds me in her hands. When I imagine that I am being held in the hands of someone who is looking after me, who guides and nurtures me, then, on the other hand, I devote myself to that. Not to a Hindu god, not to a Buddhist god, but to the Lord of Life, who cares for me and nurtures me, and to whom I trustfully surrender. So there is a story there, too. We'll have to think more about that story as well. But the basic idea of it is clear for us, that this is not a sectarian practice, but it's a practice in which every tradition shares that there is a love and there is a nurturance that occurs from the infinite to the finite. And all the practices of yoga really, in one way or another, make that true. Is that it?
There's two more. The third question. I really want to be able to meditate, but every time I sit down to try, my mind becomes extremely active, with thoughts, memories, feelings, and concentration feels like torture. I can't help but feel like I'm a failure at meditation, and it's hard to stay inspired to keep trying. What can I do?
First of all, the process of meditation is a systematic method. So when I begin farther than from the beginning point, wherever that beginning point is, I challenge myself and make it very difficult to be successful. So it's important in the beginning to pay attention to the starting point. And it's not always that the starting point is enlightenment. It could be that the starting point is simply I don't feel my best and I would like help with that. Or I want to relax my nervous system and I begin with relaxations lying down. Or I may need to do some things with relaxations on my stomach so that I can release fears and tensions. It is true that what comes up in meditation comes from the unconscious, but it's also true that hardly any of us in our world are daily meditators. And when we do sit, it's not at all surprising to discover that we don't sit as a daily meditator, we sit as a beginner. So certainly one of the things that a person who's struggling getting going would want to do would be to acknowledge the simplicity of meditation. Just sit quietly, close your eyes, and be with yourself, with your breath and stillness, so that you don't, and I don't take on more than we can take on. But then, from that point, remembering that there is a method and following that method in its own systematic way will make it possible for really virtually everyone to get started. And once we're started, then we can decide whether we like it or not, whether it's helping us or not. And certainly meditation as a tool, meditation as an aid to becoming quiet inside, might be something you can catch on to with this systematic method. Yeah.
Great. Before I go into the last question, I just want to let everyone know that if you'd like to come study in person with Rolf, he does have a program coming up at the end of March, the 23rd through 26th of March of this year. The Healing Art of Yoga, so you can hear more from him here at the Himalayan Institute.
I can say, too, that I think that'll be a very interesting program. really, truly, the process of thinking about yoga as a healing art wakes us up to what's possible in meditation and gives us a starting point. So, yeah, if you'd like to come, I'd be glad to have you come.
With that, the last question is, My goal is enlightenment, samadhi. However, it seems like it will take a very long time if I just continue with my practice as it is. Is there anything I can do to fast track my practice to reach that goal?
One of the things that strikes me right away is that is a very good thing. We sometimes underestimate the degree to which we look for the infinite and want something greater than ourselves in our life. And to not have that and to not look for it and to imagine that our meditation is just for stress management hardly seems worth doing. So if we can really imagine that the goal of life is somehow served by this practice, that in itself will help us go faster. Then you have to admit that faster is sometimes slower. Thinking that you're going to go fast slows you down. Thinking that you're going to go slow speeds you up. There's a story about two men under a tree, and as they are sitting there, one of the celestial gods comes by and notices that they're conversing about meditation, so stops in to see what they're saying. One of the men is saying to the other, "I wonder how long it'll be before I'm enlightened." And the other is saying, "Well, I don't know." And so this celestial being says, "Well, I can tell you." And so to the first person, he says, 3, 4, maybe 6 or 7 more lives and you'll be there. But the person is so disappointed, he goes away weeping. It's going to take 6 or 7 more times to be enlightened. The second man says, "How about for me? Well, how many will it take for me?" And they're under a tree, so the god says, "Look up into that tree. How many leaves do you see?" And the person says, "Well, I see many leaves, way more than I can count." And the god says, "Well, that's about as many lifetimes as it will take you." At which point the man leaps up and down, smiling and laughing and so joyful. And the god says, "Why are you so joyful? I just told you it'll take you gazillions of leaves on this tree to be enlightened." He said, "I just want to know it's possible." So that might also be helpful, just to know that it's possible. And for that, practice. I think that we are allowed to have a little time for practice ourselves, aren't we? So this might be a good time to sit in your chair. If you're at home and you can do it, you can sit in your meditation seat. Let your eyes close. You can sense the sounds around you, the sense of space, the feeling of your own body. Gradually, feeling your body from head to toe, you begin to soften the way you hold your legs, soften your arms, soften the way you hold your trunk, neck, and head. And as you soften your body and the way you hold it, you let the body enter into a feeling of stillness. You rest in that feeling of stillness. let your whole body rest. Next, you bring your awareness to the flow of your breathing. You're not so much focused on the mechanics of breathing. But feel the flow out and feel the flow in. Breathing without pause between breaths. Let the breath flow at the pace that seems natural, comfortable for you. Your breath is just right. And as you let the breath flow at this comfortable, steady pace, you begin to sense that you are not the breather. Not the one making the breath flow. You are the observer, the witness. And your body breathes. Now, in some simple way, collect your awareness. Collect the awareness that's been focused on breathing. Draw it upwards. Let it rest in the feeling of the breath touching in the nostrils. And as you bring your awareness to the breath in the nostrils, certainly there will be other thoughts. Certainly there will be distractions. But you are the witness. You are the observer. Those thoughts pass through your mind. Like the wind through an empty space. As you feel the breath, inhaling, quietly think the sound so. Exhaling, quietly think the sound hum. Feeling the breath in the nostrils, thinking the sound in the mind. The observer in you is also the one collecting your attention and resting it. The observer is also the focuser. Inhaling so, exhaling hum. Now inhaling, bring your awareness to the eyebrow center, just at the core of the mind. Inhale so, exhale hum, just at that eyebrow center. I am that. Finite in me is also the infinite. So now, rest in the sound of the mantra. And let the sound of the mantra fill your mind. You relax your body. Relax your breathing. Relax your mind. Let this very real vibration of a sound fill you. And give you peace. Om, peace, peace, peace. When you're ready to come out of the meditation, breathe a little deeper. Re-engage your body. Perhaps you might like to bring your eyes open to your hands, hands up to your eyes. Then draw your awareness out. So, I would like to thank Serena and the many other people who are involved in doing this, and wish you all well.